As parents, we try to shield our children from the hard truths of life for as long as possible. Violence, racism, slavery. As Americans, these truths are woven so tightly into our fabric, it's imperative to shed light on them. But how? Illustrator and author Kadir Nelson does so in his new book, Heart and Soul, The Story of America and African Americans. And he joins us now in the studio to talk about this latest project. So glad you're here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to start with the voice that you decide to use to tell this story, and, mm-hmm. and maybe we can begin with the prologue. Would you mind reading that for us?
Oh, not at all. Most folks my age and complexion don't speak much about the past. No parent wants to tell a child that he was once a slave or made to do another man's bidding, or that she had to swallow her pride and take what she was given, even though she knew it wasn't fair. Our story is chock full of things like this, things that might make you cringe or feel angry, but there are also parts that'll make you feel proud or even laugh a little. So it's important that you pay attention, honey, because I'm only going to tell you this story but once.
Therein begins the story, and it goes through chronologically sort of a history of America, and particularly history of African Americans. Kadir, when you were reading that, you were talking about many of us. And mm-hmm. you weren't necessarily talking about yourself, your cohort. You were speaking in someone else's voice. How did you find the voice that you wanted to use to tell this story?
Well, when I start each project, I have to start from a loving place. I love my grandmother to pieces. So I thought I'd use my grandmother's voice because she really gives it to you straight. She's the matriarch of our family. But I also wanted to sweeten it up a little bit, you know. It's kind of like a spoonful full of sugar. It helps the medicine go down. So I thought of my friend, Debbie Allen, who's from Texas. And she talks with a bit of a Texas twang. And she puts honeys and childs at the end of every sentence to sweeten it up a bit. So I would combine those two voices to find the voice for this narrator.
Are you talking about Debbie Allen, the singer and dancer and performer and sister of Felicia Rashad?
Yes, absolutely. We worked together on the movie Amistad. And we also did a book together, so...
You have been illustrating children's books for some time, mm-hmm. and now you are an illustrator and a writer. To look at the paintings in this book, I mean, they are just majestic. They take your breath away.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm wondering if you, in looking at this, and I know I've talked to you many times, and I know that you're somewhat modest, but when you look at this, does this feel to you like that you have arrived at a special place as an artist? Is this the sort of culmination of something that's been building for a long time?
You know, a number of years ago, my uncle asked me what I wanted to do with my life. And I said that I wanted to tell the African-American story through my work. But I didn't want to just tell the African-American story. I wanted to tell the American story through the eyes of an African-American. I wanted to tell the story from this history from the ground up as if it were a story. So, and again, the best way to do that would be through this grandmother-type voice who would invite a young pup to sit on her lap and she would say, let me tell you what happened.
Well, we obviously can't tell the whole story, but I'd like to sort of sample parts of it, Kadir, if I can. And you began this with the Declaration of Independence and the role that people of color played in the fight for independence in this country.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture in this chapter that shows George Washington, and it's, you know, as you often see George Washington mm-hmm. standing, sitting really, you know, very erect on a horse, but there's someone standing beside him,
mm-hmm.
His slave,
yeah. I think it was the irony of this country that was formed, created with the concept of freedom, yet a large part of the population that was held as slaves. So, you know, we start this great story about freedom, and then we have our first president sitting on the horse, very proud of his achievement, and yet his slave is sitting there holding his hat.
You can't quite figure out what the slave is thinking when you're looking at that picture. It's kind of easy to figure out what George Washington might be thinking because his chin is so high in the air.
Right, he's very proud. What I was thinking was that, you know, the sun is rising on George Washington, but when you look at the slave, it's barely hitting his face because he's looking into the sun and kind of wondering what the future holds for not only for him, but for the rest of his African American brethren.
You know, you deal with a lot of very complex issues in this book, even the irony that a country was founded on the basis of freedom and yet so many people mm-hmm. in this country were enslaved. And you're able to do this on a level that children find accessible. And you see that when you deal with portraying defiance. And it's interesting how you do that, and I'm curious about how you settled on just the right emotion to portray. I'm thinking about the picture of the black school children who are crossing the color line, and their arms are crossed, and they're held across their books, cross-armed, mm-hmm. you know, looking kind of up under their eyebrows, as is, you know, young children showing this sort of steely resolve. How did you settle on exactly the right expression that you wanted to portray, knowing that this was intended for a very young audience and for children who may not understand what it means to be defiant mm-hmm. in quite that way?
Well, I think a lot of language is unspoken, and I wasn't necessarily thinking of defiance. It was more of like the quiet anger and a quiet strength. And that's what I see in my mother. That's what I see in my grandmother. That's what I see in a lot of people who are in my life, this quiet strength.
And the point of view is interesting because it looks, based on the angle, that it might be a child who's looking through the shoulders of the guards that are there to protect those children.
I often use a low perspective because it adds a bit of drama to the composition. One of the things that I learned when I worked on the movie Amistad was that, you know, I studied Steven Spielberg's films to see how he composed his different shots. And one of the devices that he uses is you have the foreground, middle ground, and background. And often he'll use the foreground to frame the shot, whether it's someone in shadow or what have you. And it's a really great device to add drama, especially when you're dealing with lights and darks. So that's one of the devices I use to heighten the drama, and particularly in this painting.
Do you use subjects or photographs?
I do. I use historical photographs to make sure that I get everything historically correct. But then I also use models. I often use myself. Or for the little girls in the school integration picture, I used my daughter and my wife.
And what did they stand arms folded? How does that work?
She did. Well, I asked my daughter to stand hands folded, ask her not to smile, and she really was a bit shy and didn't want to do it anyway. So that kind of helped because she was a bit defiant in wanting to pose for the
painting. Oh, Daddy, this is taking too long.
Exactly.
Daddy, this is taking too long.
Exactly.
Skidier Nelson, his book is called Heart and Soul, The Story of America and African Americans. Skidier, thank you.
Thank you.
A man named Ed Michaelis joins us now. Two spies walk into a bar. One spy says to the other,
"I'm sorry, Scott, you're not cleared for that punchline."
Mr. Michaelis is a 33-year veteran of the CIA and a former stand-up comic. He's now written a new book called The Secret Book of CIA Humor. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, just delighted to be here.
Is that a smile face on your CIA ID?
Well, oddly enough, it is a family day badge that we have.
So is that like bring your children to
bring
work
your
day?
Kids to work day, right. So we have people who will come in and show their kids all the cool spy stuff. And last year, one of my friends came in with his 8-year-old son and 7-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. And he is asked by his son, "Geez, this is so cool. Dad, did you actually use any of this stuff?" And he comes up with the standard line, "Well, son, if I told you, I'd have to kill you."
Oh.
The son says, "Tell my sister."
Now, do I have this right? You actually started a comedy club in the CIA?
I did. I wanted to try out some of the material that I was using for regular comedy clubs in D.C.
Yeah.
And eventually I learned that, you know, this is a lot tougher than it looks when the professionals are doing it. So did it for a little while, then decided, let's keep the day job.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's a little bit like being a spy, right? I mean, that looks irresistible when you see it in Casino Royale. But on the other hand, as you know, you were undercover for a while, right?
I was indeed. And your first day on the job, you walk in and you're hoping to be Jack Bauer. And you fill out little forms that say, here's what your alias is going to be. Mm-hmm. So I was filling out, I want to be Buck Steele. I want to be Rock Hardy. I want to be a cool-sounding spy. Mm-hmm. They hand me the material. Who am I going to be? Hiram Quinton Willoughby.
not exactly the kind of name that people make movies about those characters, right?
A name that strikes terror in the hearts of the Taliban.
Should American taxpayers, American citizens, be reassured or alarmed that CIA officers are telling jokes?
You should be delighted that we are. It's an indication of creativity, first of all. Second, you don't want a crowd that has bad morale working for you. Every study that you ever look at regarding humor says that if you have humor in the workplace, you got high morale, you got great productivity. So absolutely you want it. We also were hired in part to recruit spies to steal secrets. And you want somebody that you can relate to. You want to have someone who's going to look to you as a friend that you're working with. So absolutely we're recruiting the right kind of people.
So a sense of humor is important in defining that.
Absolutely it is. You know, we don't take ourselves too seriously, but we certainly take the mission seriously.
Tell us one of your favorites, if you could.
Why did this case officer cross the road? To make sure that surveillance was going to follow him.
You guys think that's really funny?
You know, that just kills in training. Apparently I'm not going to be using that, though, at the next comedy club that I do.
No, I don't judge it by my reaction alone. Wouldn't an alternative punchline be, you know, something like, I'm sorry, we can't confirm or deny that the operative has crossed the road?
Let me write that down, if you don't mind. I'll use that one instead.
Mr. Michaelis, thanks very much.
Hey, honored to be here. Thank you.
Ed Michaelis is the author of The Secret of the Secret Book of CIA Humor, but he joined us very openly in our studios.
During stressful times in American life, many of us look back on our history for comfort or guidance. So it may be no surprise that an upcoming book by Chris Matthews, the MSNBC television host, is a biography of President John F. Kennedy. Earlier this year on Morning Edition, Robert Redford discussed his movie about the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. And now Bill O'Reilly of Fox News has put out a book called Killing Lincoln. O'Reilly and his co-author, Martin Dugard, examine the plot against the president at the end of the Civil War in April of 1865, and they also reconstruct the final days of Lincoln's life. Bill O'Reilly, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate you having me in.
What draws you to Lincoln and to that particular moment?
Well, I'm very concerned about leadership in America right now, and this isn't a knock on any specific elected official, but I think that we are lacking leadership. And in my opinion, I'm a former history teacher, got a history degree from Marist College. Mm-hmm. President Abraham Lincoln was our best leader for a variety of reasons. And I wanted to draw attention to him and write a book that was very dramatic and very exciting to read, but at the same time show Americans what true leadership is so that they can compare it to what we have today and perhaps maybe seek out better leaders.
Well, I love that you bring up Lincoln as an example because so many people admire him today, of course. But you also write in this book, this is a quote from the book, in the present tense, in 1865, he is by far the most despised and reviled president in American history. What made him seem that way to a lot of people at the time?
Well, obviously the South hated him, and many in the North just didn't want to make the sacrifice. There was a lot of racism in the North, obviously. And they said, why are we losing hundreds of thousands of people and fighting this bloody, prolonged war when we don't really care that much?
Well, what made him a great leader given that circumstance that so many people were opposed to him or anxious about the course that he was taking?
Two things, perseverance and compassion. Even in the darkest days, Lincoln didn't give up. He didn't panic. He stayed and he fought hard. And the compassion is demonstrated by Lincoln's every week, Lincoln would accept correspondence from the regular folks. And I write in Killing Lincoln, it's an amazing situation. You could go to the White House. Anybody could roam around. If you wanted into the White House, they would let you go into the physical building and roam around. And there was no security to stop you. There were actually people who Abraham Lincoln didn't know sleeping in the hallways of the White House trying to get to Lincoln with a petition or whatever, and he would take some of those petitions.
He would see people. He would give them
time.
He
would see, absolutely, widows and people who were in trouble, and then he would turn over their letters and write things on the bottom of the letter, let this be done, let this woman see her son who's incarcerated, whatever it may be. Very, very compassionate man on an individual basis.
What did you think when you went back and read the media in those days? You know, they would say that Lincoln's a dictator, that Grant's a drunk, that General Sherman is insane. Everybody was ripped up at one time or another.
Well, it's what the media is today. The media remarkably hasn't changed since Benjamin Franklin was printing Poor Richard's Almanac. The media is a bunch of gutter snipes and, you know, low. What can I tell you? I mean, look, I'm in the media. I've been doing it for 35 years. I know the media as well as anybody in the world knows it. And there are always going to be people who try to make money by slamming other people and by, you know, creating all kinds of stuff that doesn't really get us anywhere.
Do you think you add to that sometimes?
You know, I try not to do it personally. I think that we bring a robust debate to the nation every night. I think we try to stay away from the personal stuff. We try to back up our opinions with facts. So, yeah, I mean, you can accuse me of anything you want, but, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing.
What do you think when you hear people complain about the quality, not just of the media, but of political discourse today, that it's departed from reality, for example?
Well, I mean, if it's departed from reality, then we have to isolate the people who are doing that. President Obama was right in his Arizona speech. He said, look, you know, you can't inflame to the point where you hate each other. That's not what America is supposed to be. But what can he do? I don't see him, his rhetoric, he doesn't do that. I don't see personal attacks coming from Mr. Obama. But some of his acolytes, they just can't help themselves. And on the other side, there are people who just hate him. And everything he does is bad. And I criticize those people just as much.
Some people will know that you interviewed President Obama at least twice. Is it twice so far?
Yeah, twice.
And if I'm not mistaken, after one of those interviews in the White House, he took you to the Lincoln bedroom to look around.
Yeah, both President Bush, who I interviewed three times, and President Obama know that I'm very interested in Abraham Lincoln. And both presidents are as well, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush is a very strong student of Lincoln. And President Obama, he has studied Lincoln in the same way I did on a personal level. So after the Super Bowl interview was over, he was kind enough, the president, to take me up to the Lincoln bedroom, which I had never been there before. And then there in the bedroom on a podium is Lincoln's handwritten Gettysburg Address that he wrote out in his own hand. And I mean, it almost makes you cry.
You're also writing, Bill O'Reilly, about a period in history where I think it's fair to say the political system broke. There was this great issue facing the country. They tried to deal with it. They couldn't deal with it over time. And in the end, it led to a war and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Do you wonder if the political system is breaking now?
Well, I don't think it's breaking. I mean, I think we have a robust two-party system in the United States. We have a media that, while flawed and irresponsible in many levels, does keep an eye on what's going on. And that the people really get both sides of the story. And most Americans overwhelmingly love their country. So I don't see any fracture along those lines. I do see that zealotry probably is way higher than it should be. Dishonesty in the media is almost at a scandalous level. But there's so much media now with the PCs and all of that social network. There's so much that I think Americans, if they really try and they think, they can get the real story.
Although I'm just thinking about the media today. If Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address today, it would be far too long for an evening news soundbite. It'd be far too long for a tweet. Somebody would write about it on a blog that favored Lincoln, but other people might ignore it or denounce it. I just wonder.
Yeah, but it would probably still get on C-SPAN, and it would probably still get on all the internet sites, the Hate Lincoln and Love Lincoln sites. So, you know, it's a balance. I think Abraham Lincoln would be proud of his country today. He would certainly be proud that it elected a man like Barack Obama of mixed race. Certainly Lincoln would be proud of that. And I don't see it as dire as some other people see it. I'm fairly optimistic that if we can get this economic stuff under control, America will make a stunning comeback.
Bill O'Reilly is co-author with Martin Dugard of Killing Lincoln. Thanks very much.
All right, Steve. Pleasure to talk to you.
Film critics sometimes say that the stars of the silent era were the most accomplished actors because they couldn't utter words. Talents like Chaplin and Valentino, Mary Pickford and Buster Keaton had to reveal a range of emotions with their eyes. One admirer wrote of his favorite actor, He shows in his expression and acting such deep human contrasting feelings as trust and distrust, sorrow and joy, jealousy and love, hatred and devotion. Those raves were for an actor named Rin Tin Tin. He was one of the most famous names in the United States for much of the 20th century, a star of movies and television, and of course, a dog. Susan Orlean has written a book about how an orphan dog became part of millions of households and hearts in a way that may reveal the changing bonds between humans and animals, too. Her book is Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Susan Orlean, who's also a New Yorker writer and the author of several previous bestsellers, including The Orchid Thief, joins us from NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Scott.
And Rin Tin Tin was an orphan of the First World War.
And that fact alone is what really propelled me into this book, because I grew up at a time when Rin Tin Tin was a television star, but he was a character. I had no idea he was a real animal who had a life that was extraordinary. And being born on a battlefield in the middle of the war, being found by an American GI and brought back from France to the early days of Hollywood.
Lee Duncan was the name of the soldier, and he sees a horrifying sight in the landscape of the battlefield, and that's a kennel filled with German shepherd dogs that had been destroyed, one assumes, by artillery fire. In the middle, literally, of this destruction and death, he finds these puppies.
I can only imagine that for anyone this would have been a highly emotional moment. You know, you're surrounded by death. This was the middle of the war. It was just death every which way. In the middle of it, to find a new litter of puppies for anybody would be emotional. For Lee Duncan, this was a moment that changed his life.
And almost from that moment, Lee Duncan seems to have thought that this dog he began to call Rin Tin Tin, Rinty, he called him, had star power.
Isn't that funny? To put some context here, during the silent film era, dogs were on par with human actors. Nobody had the power of speech. A dog was just as credible as a character conveying through gesture and action and the look on its face. A dog was just as good as a human at doing that, and frankly, more natural.
Let me draw you out a bit about Rin Tin Tin's acting ability, because you maintain that he was not just a well-trained dog who could, you know, do tricks, but that he was a genuine actor. And you write at some length about what amounts to his defining role, his Hamlet, Clash of the Wolves, a 1925 film.
If you see this film, you'll come to understand why he was so successful. He's a great action star. He was a tremendous athlete. In fact, the very first thing of Rin Tin Tin that ever was caught on film was him clearing an 11-foot fence. And this was an 80-pound dog, so he was an incredible athlete. He, though, genuinely acted. His face is immensely expressive. He was very good at looking depressed. And the moments in Clash of the Wolves that are very moving are the ones where he's injured, where he's leaving his mate behind, where he thinks he's going to die, and he's leaving the pack to go and die on his own. And you're really affected by the look on his face and his performance.
I mean, he plays the leader of a wolf pack because he's half dog, half wolf in the film. He climbs a tree. I find this so impressive. He fakes a limp.
He fakes a limp so convincingly that Lee Duncan had to spend a great deal of time explaining to people that he was acting, and it wasn't that Lee had injured the dog in order for him to limp convincingly.
One of the many pleasures of this book is the historical breadth of the story, including that one of Rin Tin Tin's biggest fans was a little girl living in Amsterdam.
One of Rin Tin Tin's greatest fans was Anne Frank. She dreamed about having a dog just like Rin Tin Tin. She wrote about it in her diary for her very last birthday before she was sent to the camps. Her greatest wish was to go to a Rin Tin Tin film with her friends. As it happened at that time, the Nazis had already forbidden Jews from attending any public theatrical events. So her parents managed to get a copy of Lighthouse by the Sea, one of Rinty's films, and showed it to Anne and a group of her friends in their home. What's heartbreaking and the great irony in this is that another one of Rin Tin Tin's greatest fans was none other than Adolf Hitler, who loved German shepherds and elevated them to a status that was almost unheard of.
Any great actor worries about age. And, of course, an actor who is a dog has a particularly short professional life. So after about 8 or 9 years in the movies, well, I want you to get us to tell us about the death of the original Rin Tin Tin and how the world reacted.
It was just like every other Hollywood death. Much legend surrounded it. There were many, many rumors that actually Rin Tin Tin had died in Jean Harlow's arms. What was amazing to me was that there was a national news bulletin that went out immediately, interrupting programming all over the country, announcing his death. The next day, there was an hour-long broadcast about Rin Tin Tin that was played all over the country. It was seen as a great national tragedy when he died.
You know what touched me most about that section, though, I must say?
What's that?
Was the way in which Lee Duncan, who picked him up as a little puppy from the embers of World War I, still cherished him as his buddy, as his dog. His grief seemed entirely personal.
Entirely. The formative moment in Lee's childhood was when he was 4 or 5 years old, when his mother, who had been abandoned by her husband, simply couldn't make it. She took Lee and his sister to Oakland, California, and she left the children at an orphanage. They had no idea if she would ever return to take them back. He was desperately lonely, and his mother, after 5 years, was able to come back and get her children, and she then went to live with her parents on a huge ranch in Southern California. There were no other kids around. And then he got a dog, and the dog became his true companion. And I think he found a kind of steadfastness with the dog that he hadn't found with his own mother. And that was where it began for him. It really can bring you to tears, because the fact is that his entire livelihood was Rin Tin Tin. He was a rich man from Rin Tin Tin's movie career, but you never felt that that superseded his emotional connection to the dog as his dog.
Lee Duncan, I guess, would people would contact him from all over the country and say, I've always wanted a dog like Rin Tin Tin, and he would give them puppies, progeny.
He loved the idea of continuing the legacy of Rin Tin Tin. I mean, when the original Rin Tin Tin was alive, what mattered to him was his relationship with the dog. Then it became the idea of keeping him alive. And Lee would say, there will always be a Rin Tin Tin.
Susan Orley, her new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
Let me tell you about Matthew Henson. Some historians say he was the first explorer to set foot on the North Pole, but he happened to be black, and the year was 1909. So as you can imagine, the credit went to his white companion, Robert Peary, even though he wasn't really able to set foot on the North Pole.
Something had happened to him, like maybe just worn down by cold, and he was kind of driven the last bit of the way, I think, by Henson.
By Henson, the black man, who does eventually get his revenge in a comic strip by Canadian cartoonist Kate Beaton. As Beaton retells this story, the white explorer, Robert Peary, demands that his black associate help him from the sled so he can stand on the North Pole and get all the glory. But Henson refuses. He stands there gloating. Man, it's pretty nice being on the North Pole. Gonna do some squats on the North Pole. Feels good. And that's just one example of the way historical events like this get rewritten in Hark a Vagrant, Kate Beaton's new book. And Kate joined us from New York. Something that hooked you clearly was the Kennedy dynasty, as it were.
I love the Kennedys. Yeah, amazing.
One of your strips, one of you will do it by God. And it's Joe Kennedy basically trying to get his sons to understand that one of them must be president.
Yeah. The Kennedys are fascinating because I'm Canadian and this is like a big American thing. And they're such a big part of the culture around here of like celebrity and politics and all of that. So they really fascinate me. And that drive that they all had to go and to succeed and to push that all came from their father is really fascinating to see.
But at the end of the strip, you have Father Joe Kennedy looking down at Ted Kennedy and not a lot of drive.
No, he's just a baby. He's just like, it's just that the joke is that he's the, you know, the over-expecting father who's expecting way too much.
Ted is a little baby on the floor burping and dad is saying, Ted, what about you? What are your ambitions?
Ted doesn't know.
Have you ever crossed the line? I mean, have you gone too far and had family or an historian call and say, you know, Kate, that was just disrespectful and wrong?
Well, that's the reason I often stay away from very modern things. A certain amount of time passes and then you're allowed to get in there and get a little dirty with some things that people don't mind. But if I take something, you know, from the past 50 years, there are still people who, you know, this needs to be treated with respect and they might get a little sore at stuff. And I totally understand. I don't know. We can make fun of Napoleon. He was an awful man who killed all kinds of people.
and he can't call you and complain.
Yeah. And if Napoleon existed 20 years ago instead, people would be like, how could you belittle this? This awful, awful man and the things that he did.
You do cartoons for The New Yorker. Is there a different process when you're working with, you know, such a reputable magazine as opposed to your own website where I guess it's, you know, you feel less constrained?
I wanted to do the New Yorker cartoons because I had these comics on the internet and you could just put them up and no one was going to tell you no. And I really wanted to do something where you had to be good enough to get in. I can get away with a lot in a comic strip with speech balloons coming from people's mouths, more so than I can get away with a one-shot panel where you have to be very concise and very clear about what's going on. And I learned that I, you know, composition-wise and everything, it has to be very clear.
Kate, tell me about this format. What can you do in comics and cartoons that you just can't do anywhere else?
Oh, gosh. The magical thing about comics is that they are neither just art or writing. They're both at the same time, and that's a huge thing. You could say so much with a few words and a gesture and an expression or the shading or the mood or the lighting or whatever. I don't know if I'd be a very good artist on my own. I don't know if I'd be a very good writer, but comics seem to suit me just fine.
When you delve into the subject of Canada, thank you, by the way, because you give us this guide. You put the faces with the names. And I, no offense to the country of Canada, but I had no idea who these people were, these Canadian luminaries. And I guess as people read your book, do they need to know who the historical figures are? Is it better if they don't know and they look it up on their own?
I get a lot of comments from people who say part of the fun of reading the comics that I make is coming across a historical figure or something that they had not known before and then looking it up and being happy to have learned that and to learn about them and everything. And I've felt the same because sometimes people will send me suggestions, you know, why don't you look this person up? Like I did a comic about Rosalind Franklin and I hadn't heard of her before and somebody suggested that I look her up. So I did and I was all the more richer because I did.
And who is she? What did you learn?
She was a researcher along with Watson and Crick who discovered DNA breakthroughs and her discovery was sort of eaten up by them, was put into their research when they put out their big DNA book. And that was immense. That was a huge thing. And she sort of got shuffled off because they didn't acknowledge her work. And the double helix, that was her contribution.
You have these little descriptions at the bottom that kind of help people along. And I'm reading from the bottom of that strip. The trouble with reading about any given woman who was born before your mom is that, yes, sometimes they were hilarious, powerful, tough, loud, et cetera, all good comic-making material. But then sometimes, man, the main thing about them is that they just got screwed big time.
Yeah, because as soon as I put that strip up, I got so many emails that were like, please make a comic about this woman. She was amazing, and her work was stolen and never credited, and that seemed to happen all the time. And it's nice to celebrate that person who was left out. And people really want to be on their side. You know, Rosamund Franklin has so many fans now, especially among young women who go into the sciences and have these heroes to look up for. And they're furious that they've been left out of the narrative, you know?
You do seem to be fighting for people who were left out of the historic narrative in a way.
But I don't always. You know, I make a lot of comics about the big, blustering white men. They're fun, too. And more people know who they are. It's nice to make a comic and put it up and have more people be in on the joke right away, you know? If you make a comic about Napoleon, everybody knows who he is.
That's Kate Beaton. She is the author of the new book, Hark, a Vagrant. Thanks, Kate.
Yeah, thanks.
You can read some of Kate Beaton's comic strips at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.